Good morning. I'm Chris Vandercook. This morning we'll look at a county-by-county evaluation of Hawaii's economy from the University of Hawaii's Economic Research Organization. And philosophers from around the world will consider issues related to a sense of place at the 11th East-West Philosophers Conference.
And I'm Kathy Kozak. Technology reigns, but what happens when you actually have to communicate with people? The latest production at Kumu Kuhua Theater, hashtag I'm bad at this, we'll talk with actor Sean Thompson, and the Honolulu Jazz Quartet celebrates their 15th anniversary together at Blue Note Hawaii. John Kalivas is in the studio.
It's Monday, May 23rd. Those conversations and a few more after the news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Dr. Kathy Kozak.
I'm let out of my office for another week again.
I've got doctors on either side of me this morning, so it's kind of, I feel elevated.
You're surrounded.
It's exactly right. We're talking about which side our bread is buttered on this morning, and Hawaii's economy is and always will be dependent to some degree on outside forces. Our physical isolation and the importance of tourism to the local economy mean we need to keep a close eye on trends far from home as well as those close at hand. That's the business of UHERO, the University of Hawaii's economic research organization, which has just released a county-by-county report on the state's economy. Dr. Carl Bonham is the UH Economic Research Organization's executive director. He's with us this morning. Good morning, Carl. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Having said that about our dependence on outside forces, it actually looks as if internal forces are keeping the economy in pretty good shape at the moment.
Well, we've sort of gone through that stage where we recover from the Great Recession, and you've got jobs back at record levels, unemployment rates down 3% statewide, mm-hmm. and sub 3% on Oahu. And so, you know, people are back to work. Incomes rose pretty quickly in the last couple of years. And that means that, we're sort of generating a fair amount of economic activity just buying and selling from each other. And whether it's, you know, building new condos or building new houses or renovating properties or, just going out to eat more. So all those things matter.
The recession you refer to is what, 6 years ago, 7 years ago?
It basically ended in 2009, mm-hmm. right? So we're talking seven years back, and yeah. The growth didn't really start much until 2010. So we've been growing about 6 years.
Mm-hmm. What fueled the growth initially?
So from the outset, it was really recovery in the tourism sector. Mm-hmm. It was that, basically during the Great Recession, everybody in the rest of the world, particularly on the U.S. mainland, sort of stayed home and worried about whether they had a job.
Yeah.
By 2010, that was sort of past us, and we had pent-up demand, and we had very, very strong growth in tourism, really between 2010 and 2015, with mm-hmm. a few pauses in there. And then there was in the tourism sector, there was the expansion into brand-new markets, Australia, New Zealand, sort of recovery of a market in South Korea and the market in China. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of your initial expansion, and really construction has taken over in the last few years as the growth leader.
Fueled by what? Rail, home building?
Well, all of it. I mean, the not so much single family home building for sure, but mostly commercial. Right, we've seen mm-hmm. quite a bit of retail expansion with the renovation at Ala Moana and or the expansion of Ala Moana mm-hmm. and new retail in Kapolei and on the outer islands and high rise development in Kaka'ako, of course, but also resort development. We've got a new Ritz-Carlton, a second tower plan. You've got timeshares across the islands, and mm-hmm. And really what we're hoping to see now is sort of a transition to more single-family housing development on Oahu and on the neighbor islands.
You would certainly think to look at Kaka'ako today that this was a tremendous boom underway, but it's pretty isolated to that area, isn't it?
Well, it is. It still matters, but it's not nearly enough housing to accommodate all of the housing, that is needed statewide. The the housing that, say, Alexander and Baldwin is putting in on Maui is single-family housing and townhomes. We need more of that kind of activity on the neighbor islands and on Oahu, and we think that we're going to get it over the next several years. And the real question for construction is how many years can this construction cycle continue? Our forecast is for it to slow down. We saw 10% growth in construction jobs last year. Last year we passed the previous peak of construction jobs on Oahu, and now we're past that statewide. And so we think we're going to see another year of stronger. We've seen about 20% growth in construction jobs in the first quarter of this year. So we think we're going to have another year of strong growth this year, but then it's going to slow down.
Well, those numbers would almost have to slow down, wouldn't
yes.
they?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. Yeah, you can't keep up, you know, double-digit or even high single-digit growth rates for very long.
The outcry for affordable housing, workforce housing, people in the middle class whose incomes have sort of stagnated wanting to, you know, do that American dream thing. It's not that healthy a climate for that area, is it?
Well, it's difficult. I mean, if you talk to developers who are trying to build, whether affordable or workforce housing, they'll tell you, even if the land is essentially free or is provided on very, very long-term, you know, favorable lease rates, it's still very hard to make the math pencil out, if you will, to make the project viable.
Simply
because of, so if the land is essentially free, then the rest of it's really about building costs. So it's a challenge. And, you know, one of the things that needs to happen is that city and county land, state land that might be available around rail stations, for example, assuming rail keeps going. You know, we need to be able to figure out ways to make that available to developers, and we need to be able to provide the infrastructure for those areas, whether it's sewer, water, electrical. You can't put all that on the developer, particularly if you're talking about trying to build housing that's more in the moderate priced range.
Have local governments kept up with infrastructure?
Not in the United States,
which is where we are.
This is a problem in Hawaii. It's a problem everywhere.
Yeah.
And you know, if you drive in this state, or if you ride the bus and you feel the bumps, you know that we haven't kept up with infrastructure. And it's not just it's not just the roads. It's our schools. It's University of Hawaii's buildings. It's airports. One positive thing is we are seeing some significant investments in the airports, and there's still the Harbor Users Group's plans for infrastructure development in the harbors as well.
Is it tough to motivate government leaders to take care of long-term projects like infrastructure rather than things that maybe give them more immediate benefit, immediate credit?
Yeah, I mean, it's human nature. I think that's the case.
Makes sense.
Policymakers certainly recognize the importance, but take look at an example of air conditioning our schools. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not a new problem.
Right.
We've known about this for decades.
Yeah.
So apparently it's hard to get these things done.
So that really puts it in a different – so benefit is not the only consideration in a lot of these things.
That's right. And you know, you go through periods where budgets are particularly tight, such as during the downturn, and there's always concern over the amount of borrowing that the state might do or the city might do for various projects. So it's not just a benefit calculation.
Yeah. Well, I'm not trying to inject doom and gloom because this is, for the most part, a pretty positive report, isn't it?
It is. It's we've talked a lot about sort of where we think the peak is going to happen in terms of growth rates, and it's probably last year or this year, and it's pretty good growth rates. There's risks out there that could turn this down, but it's a pretty positive outlook.
Well, we'll choose to be cheered up, at least for the moment. Thanks so much, Carl.
Thank you.
Dr. Carl Bonham is the UH Economic Research Organization's Executive Director and a professor of economics. He's a founding member of UHERO in 1997. And you can learn more about the forecast on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Mistakes were made.
There were mistakes in leadership, mistakes in communication. There were huge mistakes in the basic assumptions about the war.
A former soldier, now Secretary of State, and a commander-in-chief visit a former war zone. Obama's Vietnam moment. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14. Coming up, how technology has changed how we communicate with one another, the inspiration for a local play. But first, your quiz.
Umurokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhangaiti.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a local girl who became a successful actress and television host after winning an impressive trio of beauty pageants. She was born in 1971 in Pearl City and is of Korean, Hawaiian, Chinese, Dutch, Portuguese, English, and French descent. She's a 1989 graduate of Kamehameha Schools, who graduated from Chaminade University with a Bachelor of Arts degree in English. She was working on her master's degree in communications at the University of Hawaii at Manoa when she entered and won the Miss Hawaii USA pageant in 1997. That led her to Shreveport, Louisiana, and the Miss USA pageant a few months later. She won that one, too, and was on to the 46th Miss Universe pageant, held on 16th of May, 1997, at the Miami Beach Convention Center in Miami Beach, Florida. That's where she was crowned Miss Universe, winning over 73 other contestants. This morning, we're looking for her name, and we'll be back with it in a half hour. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Blue Note Hawaii Jazz Club, with two shows nightly at the Outrigger Waikiki Beach Resort. Event calendar and tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
The words kumu and kahua translate to original stage, and for the past 45 years, this local theater has provided theatrical opportunities for the expression of local community lifestyles, both contemporary and historical. Hashtag I Am Bad At This is their latest offering, tracing current trends in communication and the fallout from an overdependence on technological devices, including those smartphones we all know and love. Sean Thompson is a veteran of the stage, and he's here with us today to share what it takes to be good at this. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning.
Welcome to The Conversation.
Oh, thank you for having me here. I appreciate it.
Now, we were talking a little bit before the show, and one of the things that you mentioned is that you kind of fell into theater.
I did.
One of your friends said to you, join me in a drama class. And as soon as you walked in, you felt like you found home.
That is correct. They told me, I was walking down the halls. They asked me, they said, hey, you should take a theater class. Took theater class the next semester, walked in there and said, I feel at home.
That was it. Never really having done it when you were a kid. You found your calling when you were in college.
I did. It was just something that said, all right, this feels right. I'm just going to follow it and just keep on doing it.
Now, you've been in all different forms of theater. You've established an improv group for youth. You've also been live on the stage. You've also starred in Hawaii Five-0 in television as well. What's the difference in those three elements?
Oh, wow, that's a lot. Well, in live theater, you know, there's the process of going through everything, you know, rehearsing every day, trying to get it to where the director wants it to be, and then, you know, you perform it, and you perform it live, and just learning to take in everything and just doing it, what you rehearse, putting it out there. For, like, improvisation, it's really just throwing yourself in there, listening to what's happening, learning what the situation is, and just dealing with it, and that is just art in itself, I think. And then for doing film and television, it's really more or less your own practice, walking in there, as I feel, and just being ready to go. And then when you're ready, when they're ready to call action, you're there, you're in the moment, and you have to choose to stay in that moment the whole time. But very, very three different things.
Well, and it sounds like the key with all of those is that you really have to be aware of your surroundings in the moment, whether it be improv, listening to your fellow actors, or whether it be in theater where you have to know what's going on the stage. You may have rehearsed it, but that may not be what happens on opening night.
Correct, yes.
And then you've got the whole concept of television where, you know, all your practice, you gotta bring it when you get there.
Yeah.
You can't just learn it on the fly. You kind of have to know your lines, know your character, and jump right in.
Yeah, just know exactly who you are. I mean, otherwise, you know, we don't have the time to rehearse with everybody that's on there, because there's different people, different scenes. You just gotta know what's happening. And that's one of the things that I do enjoy. It's one of the greatest things that I like to learn on, especially when I get to get be on the show. So,
which one of those three do you think is the hardest?
The hardest? For me, it would be doing the TV stuff, to film and doing on TV. The only reason why is because there's so much at stake, I guess, for yourself personally. I mean, for me, for myself, I feel like there's more at stake, because you just got to walk in there and just know what's happening and just know what everybody else is doing and just know that whatever you're doing is correct.
Be ready or they won't call you back.
Exactly. That's just that's just really scary for me, I guess.
Now, what inspired you to promote improv for youth? I mean, as when you were young, you might not have participated in some of these events, and yet now it's become a goal for you to outreach to the next generation.
You know, it just so happens that it just came. Somebody asked us, "Hey, you want to do improvisation for kids?" And just like, okay, we'll see how this goes. I mean, because kids are very hyperactive, and just to gain their attention for a split moment in time is like one of the hardest things to do, especially if there's like 100 of them. And but when we started realizing that, hey, these kids can do it, and you know, you learn a lot from kids, because kids have like no shake. There's no shake in their doubt or how they feel, because they're committed to whatever it is that they want to commit themselves to, and they will tell you exactly, you know, if they don't like it, what can you do to make it better? And it's just something that, it's just listening back and forth, and they pick this stuff up, especially when you're performing, and they see you doing that. They see you acting like a kid, they respond to you. And I guess what's inspiring about it is that it's just learning from children is why I like to go and reach out and perform in front of kids. And if they're interested in it, they can work on that technique. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like a lot of your life has been people saying, come on over, come do this, you might like it. And you find out that you really do.
Yeah.
Well, so did you grow up as a kid always knowing this is what you wanted to do? Or
No idea. I mean, to be honest, I'm a very shy, inward person. But
really?
Yeah, I am. I don't really like, hey, what's going on, everybody? I mean, but more or less, I've just been that shy person, and just started doing theater and all that. It just opened me up to do a lot of other stuff.
But. Well, and maybe that's the stage brings it out of you.
Yeah.
That was when you found home.
Yeah.
Do you find like you're a different person when you're on stage?
Oh, very much so. Very more confident, if anything. Confident and knowing. And it's a great feeling. It's that rush of, you know what? This isn't about me. It's about what's happening out there and for people to enjoy. And, you know, whatever is going on in their day, this is something for them to see and watch that would, like, hey, I can relate to that. And you know what? This is how they deal with that situation. And it's, to me, it's a form of you're therapy, I guess. I don't know.
Well, and you certainly are doing a great job of it. I want to thank you for joining us this morning.
Oh, thank you.
Sean Thompson is the actor born and raised on Oahu, graduate of Waipahu High School and Leeward Community College. He's had starring roles in Hawaii Five-O, various community theater productions, and is one of the founders of the youth improvisational group In Your Face and the nonprofit Honolulu Broadway Babes. He's starring in the Kumu Kahua Theater production, hashtag I am bad at this, but as we know, he's actually really good at it. And it's opening up May 26th through June 26th. Find out more at our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Texas high schoolers in the top 10% of their class are guaranteed a place at any public university in that state, except for the flagship UT campus in Austin.
Unless you have done extraordinary things and can present a kind of a unique portfolio to the admissions office, it's very hard to get in.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hook 'em horns if you can get in. Marketplace next time.
This evening at 6, following The Body Show.
Nielsen Research tells us it's likely that 1 in 8 of your neighbors listens to Hawaii Public Radio each week. Some of them have gone beyond merely listening and, through their financial support, have made our service available to the rest of the community. Please join us in thanking these good neighbors. Roberta Burke-Stresser of Honolulu, Thane Taylor of Kalaheo, and Hannibal Starbeck of Makawao. You too can do the neighborly thing and become an HPR member donor by calling 955-8821 during business hours or by visiting hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson. For more than 2 decades, a dedicated sponsor of the softball throw at the Special Olympics of Hawaii's Summer Games. Matson.com/foundation.
Lawmakers have an uneasy relationship with issues like ethics codes and campaign finance reform, eager to give lip service, but perhaps less eager to pass meaningful legislation. Civil Beat is taking a look at the way reform measures fared in the legislative session just passed, and reporter Chad Blair has the story. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Chris.
No lawmaker is going to actively come out against ethics codes or campaign finance reform, but boosting them is a different story, right?
Well, it's pretty amazing. You know, the session's now been over for 2 weeks or so, and we tend to remember the things that passed, right? AC, yeah. Air conditioning for schools, a new state hospital, and so forth. But what gets lost in the shuffle is a whole bunch of other bills that died, in particular, as you indicated, reform bills, measures that are designed to improve our government. There were 16 bills in particular that the Hawaii State Ethics Commission was tracking, and Nathan Eagle took a look at them. All 16 of those measures died this session. Only a handful actually got a public hearing. I'll give you an example of one of them. There are others. One would have created a task force to review our state lobbying laws. They need an overhaul. They're outdated. We need to make them more effective. But that didn't even get a task force. And there are others that died as well. Folks like Common Cause Hawaii, League of Women Voters, these good government watchdog groups, disappointed that they couldn't see any of these measures get passed.
You know, we get to the end of a session, and frequently you hear not just members of the public, but even members of the legislature say, I don't know what happened to this bill. Right?
Nathan interviewed a lawmaker here on Oahu, Matt Lopresti. One or two of those bills were his. And he said it's a mystery why some bills die. And where many of them do die, that mysterious death is in conference committee. That's that 2-week period near the end of session where you know, they're making deals. They're trying to decide what's going to make it, what's not. And some bills just don't become priorities. That would include these measures. Let me give you one or two others. There was a bill that would fine lobbyists who don't actually file all those disclosure forms that they are required to do. There was another one that would have required that you report all your expenditures, not just ones that over $750. And I got to bring attention to this one. There was one to narrow the loophole for the fair treatment law. That's the law that says, you know, legislators and state employees have to be careful about not using their position to gain privilege or advantage. You can see why that might be an appealing bill to some people and not to others. That died as well. The mystery might be in part that top lawmakers are up there saying, well, this is just not a priority. Here's the things that we're going to focus on. And as you know, a conference committee is limited. Time runs out and then that's it.
Well, you know, the question is going to be raised, when is it going to be a priority, right?
Exactly. Hopefully next session, I should mention, Lo Presti has a bill that he would like to have a searchable database for lobbying reports. That way the public, reporters like me, could actually get on and find out exactly who's giving money and how much, and then report it back to people like you.
Oh, so, that's much too easy, Chad. Thanks very
Trying
much.
Trying to end a positive note. Thanks, Chris.
You bet. Every day we bring you a reality check with Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair.
Good morning. I'm Kathy Kozak, and it's 8:30. You're tuned to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Talk back about what you hear on the show on our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or at BKOZHPR. Coming up, a conference to compare the philosophies of the East and West. But first, the news from the BBC.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak, and Kathy's sitting right here, and Kathy, we're looking inward this afternoon.
Oh, yes, we are. We're going to do a gut check. You know, we're going to be talking about, there's all these new commercials you see on television, and they're all about, you know, do you have all these problems with your digestive tract, and or do you feel uncomfortable, bloated, etc.? We're going to get to the bottom of it today. We're really going to talk about what goes on with digestion, how what happens when it works well and when it doesn't, and how it may not just be about what food you eat. Could be more to it.
If you find yourself frequently getting upsets and taking, you know, a lot of Tums for the tummy on a regular basis, there might be something deeper, right?
Absolutely. And in some cases, once you've ruled out serious problems, there could just be something going on that, you know, we can help to take care of either with the foods we eat, our diet, our exercise, our lifestyle. It doesn't always have to be something where you have to reach for medication all the time. So we're really going to cover what things require pills, what things don't, and really, how can you just feel good inside and out, hopefully all the time?
It's easy to build dietary habits based on foods you like or tastes you like that aren't that good for you in the long term, right?
Oh, who doesn't crave chocolate all the time?
Well, that couldn't possibly be bad for you.
No, and coffee and dessert. But we're really going to talk about how to fix that and make it easier for everybody.
Terrific. That is The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5. The philosophies of East and West developed for centuries without much awareness of one another, either of their differences or their similarities. As a result, those differences run deep, and the East-West Center has led an effort to enhance the dialogue between them. Each has much to learn from the other. The center is the site of the 11th East-West Philosophers Conference, which begins tomorrow on the UH campus with more than 300 participants from some 40 countries. And for UH Chinese philosophy professor Roger Ames, it's the culmination of a 38-year career at UH. He's on the line with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris.
Is that accurate to say that a lot of the development in past centuries of Eastern and Western philosophy happened without their really referring much to one another?
It's true on the Western side. That is to say that even today, most philosophy departments in America and Europe don't teach anything except Anglo-European philosophy. They don't teach Islamic. They don't teach Chinese or Japanese or a Buddhist or South Asian.
They're missing quite a lot by that covers a lot of ground, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the wisdom of the world.
What do you think is behind that sort of academic isolationism, if you will?
I think it has to do with the kind of Eurocentrism that has plagued Western education for a couple of centuries.
Yeah.
You know, there's a kind of universalism that is part of European thinking that is exclusionary, you know, that makes Europe the center.
Sure. We were taught that Alexander conquered the known world when it was a fraction of the world that existed at the time, right?
And Christopher Columbus discovered a world where there were already a lot of people.
Yeah, well, the whole use of the term discovery, the age of discovery, the age of the white man figuring out what a lot of people already knew, right?
Exactly.
So how do we, well, I mean, this the conference coming up is the path out of that, isn't it?
Right. These conferences began in 1939 when three visionaries at the University of Hawaii, Greg Sinclair, that became Sinclair Library, Charlie Moore, Moore Hall, where Asian studies, Asian languages are taught, and Wingsit Chan. These three scholars sat down and said, we in Hawaii are going to be different. And so they created a philosophy department that has half Western philosophy, but the other half is non-Western. Mm-hmm. So all of those other traditions are taught within our department. And so that began sort of a conference series that comes down to today, and that has always been open to the community. So there's no conference fees. Everybody's welcome to participate. Philosophy is the production of social wisdom, and we want everybody to participate in that.
Which means everyone is qualified to make a contribution, yeah?
Absolutely. We're dealing with the pressing issues of our time. The theme is place, and that sounds abstract, but place is homelessness in Hawaii. Place is aina and sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
Place is refugees in Europe. Place is international terrorism and toilets in North Carolina.
Sure. It's that territorial instinct that goes deeper than anything we're able to completely understand, you know, that whole regionalism's behind a lot of wars and conflicts, for one thing, isn't it?
Absolutely.
You mentioned earlier when you say that obliviousness of the two traditions of one another was stronger on the Western side. In the past, have Asian philosophers looked toward, you know, did they read Schopenhauer and Wittgenstein, and were they looking to the West at all?
In some degree. Like the first wave, if we use China as an example, that's my area.
Mm-hmm.
First wave of Western learning was Buddhism, coming in from India in about 100 BCE.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second wave was the Jesuits in the 16th century, 17th century, and then the Protestants. And so the Chinese tradition has tended to be absorbent, that anything that would compete with it, it would make its own.
Hmm.
And so for these past hundreds of years, the Chinese tradition has really been comparative in its orientation. The Western tradition has become a part of its own tradition.
Well, when I think of something that's, you know, a modern philosophical tradition, say something like existentialism seems to have occurred without a lot of reference to the East at all. Is there any Asian philosophy in something like that?
Yeah, there's the Chinese tradition, something like existentialism is a rejection of sort of transcendental thinking. Existentialists don't want to talk about the truth. They want to talk about my truth.
Yeah.
So it's a reversal of gravity. So come back to the earth. But the most of these Asian traditions always were that way oriented. Confucianism is about making the ordinary extraordinary. So it starts with family. It starts with ancestors and the intergenerational transmission of culture. And so it's very this worldly, like existentialism.
That's interesting. That's a comparison I never would have made, but that's not that surprising. But it's still it's kind of fascinating when you put these traditions back together in the same room, which is what this exercise is going to be about. Yeah,
right, right. And it's it really does produce interesting conversations. It's what really makes, like, you get an education at the University of Hawaii, and it's really different from Oregon or Idaho, mm-hmm. in the sense that it's not just the philosophy department, but world history movement. I began with Jerry Bentley in the history department at UH. Sociology, political science, and so on, that we're much more capacious than most of the institutions on the mainland, and much more inclusive, given our own sort of multi-ethnic community.
It's always troubling when an academic tradition is anything other than inclusive, because automatically that means that it's limited and limiting to those who study under it, yeah?
Absolutely, and many of the problems that we are facing today, you know, I always say that we live in the best of times, we live in the worst of times.
Mm-hmm.
Best of times is we have the technology, the science, to land a rocket on a comet. If we put our stuff together, no child in the world would need to go to bed hungry or sick. We could do that now. We have the technology to do that. But then we have the perfect storm, you know, global warming and pandemic and international terrorism and all this other kind of stuff, where those problems can only be solved by working together, by understanding our interdependence as human beings and getting away from the individualism of single actors playing to win for themselves. And so the Asian culture really speaks to that kind of a problem. In Buddhism, in Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Vietnamese philosophies, interdependence is the starting point, that we're constituted by our relationships.
Well, we've been a long time arriving at that conclusion, but it does seem to be more in the air than ever before.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Yes, my pleasure, Chris.
Roger Ames is just retiring from the University of Hawaii this semester after 38 years teaching comparative philosophy. On September 1st, he'll take up his new position as humanities chair professor at Peking University. The 11th East-West Philosophers Conference begins tomorrow and runs until May 31st at the East-West Center. And as he said, all are welcome. It will focus on the concept of place, and you can learn more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
In today's Backyard Quiz, a local girl who made good as an actress and television host, getting a big boost in the year 1997 when she won the Miss Hawaii USA, Miss USA, and Miss Universe pageants, one right after another. She's a 1989 graduate of Kamehameha Schools who's been the host of several TV shows, including Hawaii Sports Adventure for ESPN, Top 10 Beaches of America, and Cruises We Love for the Travel Channel, and a behind-the-scenes look at Miss Universe for E! Entertainment Television. She was instrumental in bringing the 47th Miss Universe pageant to Hawaii, where it was held at the Stan Sheriff Arena on the UH Manoa campus. By now, you've probably remembered that we're talking about Brooke Antoinette Mahealani Lee, the only woman of Native Hawaiian ancestry to ever capture the Miss Universe crown.
And Kathy, we have a winner because Roxana Ching Kahakui of Kailua called, and she did remember that. And so she's getting the T-shirt, and at 8:45 on the nose, that's today's quiz. If you have one for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in the simply massive universe around our very small planet, plus what to look for in our dark island skies. As usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's happening?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. For this week's Stargazers, look out for a summer spectacle in your evening skies. Mars, Saturn, and the bright star Antares in the constellation of Scorpius, forming a great triangle in our southern skies. Now, all three of these objects are very bright and very easy to spot. Now, the moon this week is going to be passing through its full moon phase, which of course means it's going to be very bright in our island skies.
Now, we're returning to a subject of a mysterious dimming celestial object that Christopher has previously reported on. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. That mysterious object is a star known as Tabby's star after its discoverer. Astronomers are turning to the public in the hopes of raising money to study Tabby's star further. This mysterious star has been the source of intense speculation since it was revealed that the star experiences irregular fluctuations in brightness. That might not sound very exciting at first, but it has led to all sorts of crazy theories, from swarms of comets through to extraterrestrials.
Why are they turning to the public for help?
The star was first observed using the Kepler Space Telescope. Now, Kepler has since moved on to other targets in its mission and unfortunately isn't observing Tabby's star anymore. So the astronomers are turning to crowdfunding in the hopes of raising money to buy time on other telescopes so that they can continue to explore this mystery.
And how much dough do they need to do this?
Well, astronomers are hoping to raise around about $100,000 to buy some time on a telescope. Now, that may sound like an awful lot of money to me and you, but unfortunately that will only buy them probably about 8 hours on a big telescope.
Wow.
Indeed. Telescopes run incredibly expensive. Some telescopes can charge in the region of $10,000 per hour in order to observe, and that just covers the time to operate the telescope and to cover costs like maintenance and other things.
And on the note of what researchers think could be causing the dimming, any thoughts from yourself on what might be the cause?
Although it may be attractive to think of this exotic behavior as perhaps due to the presence of some extraterrestrial civilization, the chances are that this phenomena is more natural in cause.
But not sea monkeys in space.
If they are, they are humongous.
Could be good eating. You never know.
Yeah.
Christopher Phillips, and another fun Stargazer this week. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from HTA, a public charter school serving students grades K through 12 on each island, providing each student with the opportunity for a personalized learning plan combining face-to-face and virtual instruction. Learn more at myhta.org.
What does it take to find your musical family? Well, after 15 years of playing together in the Honolulu Jazz Quartet, they've made some of the music famous, not only in Hawaii, but also throughout the West Coast. We've got bassist, composer, and founder John Kalivas in the studio. He's going to tell us more about the anniversary celebration and what does it take to be together for a decade and a half. Welcome to the conversation, John.
Thanks. Thanks, Kathy. Great to be here.
Made you feel a little old with that decade and a half, yeah?
Yeah.
15 years. Now, you know, jazz is a very interesting type of musical genre. You know, classical music, it's written down. You play the notes. Everybody knows when you play a wrong one, particularly if you play it too loud. I've been known to do that. But, you know, with jazz, it's really more about being in the moment and playing with your fellow musicians and understanding where they're at.
That's right. In fact, Miles Davis said there are no wrong notes.
In jazz.
In jazz, yeah.
Not in classical, in jazz.
Right. Yeah, no, there's a lot of freedom to play. Of course, you have some structure in the music, but what you play is basically coming from you. And so that's what makes it fun, the interaction between the musicians.
Now, you're a teacher, and there's a certain amount of technique that you have to teach your students. But when you were first immersed in music, it wasn't necessarily to follow a particular structure. You were just kind of handed an instrument and just said, come jam with us.
Kind of. You know, my mother was a classical pianist, and so I would listen to her, what she played, and I'd try to play some of it on the piano by ear. And then later when I started to get into jazz when I was a teenager, got to play with some fine players and put into situations where I didn't know the tunes or anything what was going on, but just forced to play, and it was kind of an exciting experience.
I would be scared to death.
And terrifying.
And terrifying. So now nothing can throw you. I mean, anything that anybody says, come jam on this, come play, you might never have even heard the music, don't even know the key, but you can just slide right in there and know exactly how to use your instrument in this conversation with the other musicians. How long does it take to get that good?
I don't know. I think it takes years of experience to learn the jazz language and other music. But it's really from experience of playing with different people. You get a certain confidence to play. And, you know, you know what you can do, and you just enjoy yourself and try to contribute to the situation.
Now, you've got quite a close-knit group now. It's unusual for a lot of jazz performers to have 15 years together as a quartet, to really have such a tightly knit musical family, really, that you guys can read each other's minds and know where you're headed and know how to follow and really just mesh so well.
Yeah, it's been a privilege playing with the fine players, Tim, Dan, and Von Baron. But, you know, we, like you mentioned, we speak the same language and we just enjoy playing together. And it's been great that the group has been able to stay together all this time. Of course, we play a lot of other things, a lot of other gigs. But when we get together, it's always like a family and enjoyable.
Now, music is a language that doesn't have to be spoken, and that you could play with people who don't even know a word of English and still find that common ground, still find that ability to play beautiful music together. How is that?
Yeah, we just played recently with a performer from Japan who spoke very little English at all. But we, like you mentioned, it's a language that we know and we play. We know we've listened to similar things as we grew up in the music. And so it doesn't really matter where you're from. You just get together and you can enjoy and play the music together.
It sort of transcends geography and in some ways transcends time, because you could listen to a performance from 30 years ago of musicians who aren't even with us any further and yet still find something from that music that you can bring to your next performance.
That's right. And, you know, most of the music I've always listened to were from the masters from the past, and that's where you learn a lot. And, of course, there's so many great younger players as well, or contemporaries too. But yeah, there's certain ones you have to listen to in order to get the language.
Now, everybody always says, what makes a good musician? I'm going to ask you the opposite. What makes a not-so-good musician? What is it that people really need to focus on if they want to play music and be in such? It's almost like an improv, really. Jazz is a lot of improvisation. What are some of the characteristics that you can't have if you want to be in this genre that you've done for so long?
Well, what makes a bad musician would be one who doesn't listen. And really, especially if there's more than one player, if you're playing with others, you have to listen to each other and see where they're going, react to what they play. And you have to be a team player as well. Yeah, no one's standing out front to try to, except, you know, when it's your solo, then of course you can do what you want. But you have to be a team player and use your ears.
When you think of how you've become such a member of the jazz quartet, you said you play with other gigs, you play with other people, but when you guys come together, some kind of special magic happens. What is that?
I guess it's just the familiarity with each other, our playing styles. You have a certain comfort level playing together. And I think that's a great thing, because then from there you can build and improvise and take chances as you know that they're going to be right there with you.
Will we be celebrating your 30th anniversary in the future?
Who knows? Maybe.
You never know, but you guys have a big celebration coming up for the 15-year anniversary. Is that right?
Yeah, well, there's a beautiful club that's opened several months ago called the Blue Note Hawaii. And it's a privilege to play there because it's a famous jazz club, which started in New York. And, of course, I've been there. And then I've also performed in Japan at the Blue Note. But to be able to play here in Hawaii with such a wonderful club, I think it's been great for the island here and the jazz fans here.
Well, we're happy to have you there and also here. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks so much, Kathy.
All right. Comprised of bassist and group leader John Kalivas, saxophonist Tim Sukiyama, drummer Von Baron, and keyboardist Dan Del Negro, the Honolulu Jazz Quartet has been Hawaii's preeminent jazz quartet for a decade and a half. They've been featured with the Honolulu Symphony Pops, performed at all of the major Hawaiian islands, as well as the West Coast and three critically acclaimed recordings. The quartet eagerly looks forward to its 15th anniversary performance at Blue Note Hawaii on May 30th.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Compassion and Choices, a nonprofit committed to improving care and expanding choice at the end of life. Learn more about contributing personal stories at CompassionandChoicesHawaii.org.
When you're in Basque Country, you know you're going to be eating really well.
We always say that. How do you celebrate anything? Eating.
And if you want to shop for great food, Fred Plotkin knows just where to go in Italy.
Bologna, to me, has the best markets in Italy, and therefore the world.
Guides to eating and drinking in Basque Country, culinary highlights of Italy, and tips on how to eat like a Parisian. It's on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tuesday at 4 p.m. following Fresh Air.
Kathy, I'm pretty sure I heard the first gig of the Honolulu Jazz Quartet, which would be 15 years ago, but they were really cohesive, exciting group back then, and they've continued to grow.
Well, and you know, the idea of music being in the moment, theater being in the moment, Eastern philosophy
right.
being in the moment,
right.
we found a theme. We weren't looking for it. It found us.
Well, if you can't be in the moment and you're a jazz musician, you're in a lot of trouble because that's where it all happens.
Which is why it scares me to death that there's nothing written down and you just got to go with the flow.
Oh, it's reassuring when I look at a page and there's nothing on it. It's freedom, Kathy.
Direct opposites. That's us.
That's us. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, looking at the Department of Education and Board of Education's joint strategic plan with Alex Harris of the Harold K.L. Castle Foundation.
Plus, sitting down to talk about the beauty and pageantry of opera with Hawaii Opera Theater's general director, Simon Krukal.
We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. If you want to email us, do it at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Kathy Kozak.
I'm Chris Vandercook, and we'll meet you again in the morning for more of the Conversation.